I remember as a young child that when my dad would come home from work and he would have a bad day at work, that my mom would meet him at the door with a drink, with a highball, they called it back in those days. And so as I look back at my addiction and my patterns, that was something that stuck in my mind as to, well, this is how you deal with problems. If there's a problem in your life, you have a drink. Graduated from high school in 1964. By 1966, I was in the military. Vietnam was hot and heavy at that time. And to me, Vietnam was quite an eye-opener. I saw things in Vietnam and did things in Vietnam that had changed me forever. You know, I had been just about lost my life, I don't know how many times while I was there in Vietnam. You know, I went through the 18 months of being over there, 18, 19 months, whatever it was, and it was like one day I'm in Vietnam, the next day, a couple days later, I'm home at Travis Air Force Base. I signed my papers, got my back pay, and came home. And we had no counseling to come out or anything like that. It was just from one thing to the next, you just boom, boom. When I came home, of course, you know, the alcohol was around, and in 1970, there was a lot of drugs, and whatever you wanted was available. It was, you know, the hippie era, the free love, all of that kind of stuff. I never did really reach for thinking that alcohol was the way to anything when I was younger, before Vietnam. But after I came back, it was like, this is, you know, part of what I need to, what I use to suppress those feelings. But I was still functioning. I was at a functioning level where I maintained a job and was doing okay, paying bills and this and that. And I don't know where it was in my usage, but somewhere along the line, instead of the drugs and the alcohol helping to suppress those feelings, they start to enhance the feelings. They actually made this switch to starting to make me more anxious. I would have anxiety attacks, panic attacks, and I was searching for something to try and continually push those feelings down inside of myself. So when I stopped drinking, it was all I did was switch to taking pills, and I was stealing pills from people's medicine cabinets. I was taking stuff from where my wife worked. It just got to be really insane.
Welcome to Unhooked. My name is Pastor Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Kitty, and today we'll be talking about addictive environments.
Our guest is Jennifer Fuchs. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Jennifer, can you tell us what is the role of the environment in addiction?
Sure. I would say that's the learning piece. If addiction is what's modeled for you in your family or in the environment at large at school, then that's what you are going to learn is a coping skill and how to cope with stress and uncomfortable feelings.
Is that where we hear about generational use, what
Absolutely.
Parents do, kids are more likely to do?
Absolutely. There's a genetic component to addiction, but there's also the modeling. If that's what I see you do and you're my mom or dad, then that's something I'm very likely to pick up.
I'm a military brat. My father was in the Navy for 30 years, and I just remember being around a lot of people who were drinking and smoking and so forth, and never had an impact on my parents. But what do these environments do? What about the military? What about other environments?
I think there's a susceptibility there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of downtime. There's also a lot of stress and often trauma. We see some really sad stories come out of the guys now that are doing 3 and 4 tours and coming back. And I think that resources are trying to catch up to where they are. But a lot of times, their first experience with some kind of help psychiatrically is in chemical dependency.
So it's a high risk factor
Absolutely.
For them in their environment.
Absolutely. The culture is such that it's not just tolerated, it's kind of encouraged. It's kind of a bonding thing for a lot of the military.
You mentioned bonding, so it makes me think of adolescents and peer groups. Is that another situation of environment?
Absolutely, absolutely. If, you know, we hear parents, they're hanging out with the wrong people. We don't want them to hang out with those people. And I think people can make up their own mind, but if your environment is such that it's so influential, like at a vulnerable age, say 13, 14, something like that, if that's what your peer group is doing, then that kind of endorses it as something that's okay.
For sure. There's some situations, you know, such as a spouse that you're married to, maybe that's involved in addiction. How do you get out of some of these environments if you're just in a tough situation and there's really no way out, or the options are really limited?
Right. I think the first thing is that you have to have the desire to get out, and you have to have the willingness to change. A lot of spouses are so focused on the person that's drinking or using that they stop taking care of themselves. And so the big problem in the family becomes this person, codependency. If this person would just do what I want, then everything would be okay. And that's not really the reality. But if the spouse of the addict is wanting to change, then there's Al-Anon. They could always do private therapy, which generally is going to lead them to Al-Anon, or we have family programs. But I would say the primary thing is that they have the willingness.
Mm-hmm. And what do we do in terms of trying to change an environment? What keeps an environment, a bad environment, going? What perpetuates it?
I guess the status quo. Mm-hmm. So if nobody sees any reason to change or willingness to change, then things will stay the same. There's a saying in program that nothing changes if nothing changes.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be some kind of desire in that environment for a change to occur, whether it's somebody, a family member, or your choice not to be in that environment.
Right. It's got to start with the alcoholic or addict. A lot of people try to change for their spouse or for their family because they see the stress that they're causing and the heartache that they're causing. But unless the person themselves has the desire to quit their substance or their behavior, it's not generally successful.
What sort of stories are you hearing in your work about environments that are impacting people and moving them in this direction of addiction?
I would say, the military, like we already talked about, is one that is particularly sad, I think. We see these young, 23, 24-year-old men and women that have gone through so much. And there are so many layers, I think, that they have to deal with them one at a time. So if the addiction, generally, say they got in trouble and so that's why they end up with us, if they don't deal with that first, then you're going to have all the behaviors and the substance that is just complicating everything. So if you can deal with that first, then you can kind of get to if they have trauma issues. And then, unfortunately, a lot of times they get a lot of help and they are wanting to change their behavior, but then they go right back to the same environment. So that's what's tricky.
Here, can churches be an addictive environment? Can a church be that way?
In a good sense.
Perhaps.
If that, one of the things that we talk about in family groups is that anything that you do, regardless of whether you have negative consequences in your life, can be an addiction. So if your thinking is so rigid around, say, your religiosity, then I would say, depending on the person, it's possible.
Mm-hmm. What do we do? Let's say I'm the spouse of someone who's an addict, or I'm the child in a home where there's addiction, and you're saying that the environment could have negative consequences. What are some things that we can do?
Primarily, you have to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's something that people that grow up in addicted homes don't have modeled for them and don't really know how to do. So it's a learning thing. Al-Anon, Alateen, there's even Alitot for small children, adult children of alcoholics. These 12-step programs all kind of follow the same structure and really teach people about themselves and how to incorporate spirituality into their life to become their best self.
Yeah, some great resources you mentioned. Thanks so much. We're going to take a break and be right back.
I feel like Vietnam contributed to my addiction a lot because I was dealing with issues I didn't know how to deal with. And it was that same type of a thing of you're frustrated, you're angry, maybe you've got a lot of anxiety going on and somebody says, well, here, let's have a drink or let's smoke this or let's take these. And it did. It helped to suppress that for a while, and it was ruining my marriage, but the insanity of the disease, it just was like, well, that doesn't matter, that marriage doesn't matter, you just need to keep going, getting high, and so on and so forth. We got to a point in our marriage that I was going to just dump everything and go out on the street and just use really hard, and because what I was doing was not working anymore, just taking the pills and just trying to, you know, suppress some of this stuff. And one time I got a hold of a bunch of pills and I just, you know, took them all. And I just kind of blacked out on our couch here in our living room. And from there, it was just, you know, the next thing I remember, these guys were standing over me, a couple of guys who had worked for me and then a couple other guys. And once I kind of woke up and got my head unclogged from all the stuff I had taken, they said, well, there's this rehab program that you can go to if you go down and you talk to them and get evaluated. So the next day, my wife and I went down there. One of the first things that the counselor said to me was, John, if you really want to help yourself, educate yourself about this disease. And he gave me quite a list of different books to read, and through the counseling that we went through in this program, it was just an eye-opener to me. I think one of the easiest parts for me was, because I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired, was to just stop using. That wasn't a real big problem for me. I knew I had to do it. But the hardest part of it was now I had to start to deal with the issues that I had inside of me. What was going on deep down inside my heart and in my soul and in my mind. So that there was probably the hardest thing for me to do, was to dig into that stuff. Because part of the program was that we had to do an inventory of everything that we had done. And I thought, oh, this is going to be the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And there was, when I shared my story with everybody in the group, it was probably one of the most cathartic things I'd ever done in my whole life, because now all of a sudden, there was nothing to hide from. Everything was out. It was right there on the table. So it was like, wow, this feels good. I've got nothing to hide from anybody. And that, to me, was just a total blessing from God, because now I can talk with people and it's like, hey, I don't care. You can use whatever I say. I got nothing to hide from you. There's nothing, no secrets here.
Welcome back to Unhooked. And we're talking about addictive environments. And we're grateful for Jennifer being with us. You know, we've been talking about the military and how addiction can come about in that environment. We're not by any means trying to say that everyone who goes into the military will become an addict. We're
absolutely
grateful for their
not
service.
Absolutely, yeah. Not. It's probably a small percent, but by virtue of what I do, I see the ones that it's become a problem for. So
another example might be in sports or athletics. Sure. I would imagine so many wonderful things about that, and yet it it does have that possibility of those risk factors being in that environment.
Sure, I think young people now are using steroids much more often than they were, say, 20 years ago. So
there's something about the environment, the competitiveness, mm-hmm. or the needing to belong that sounds like it tends to be...
Yes, there's so much pressure, mm-hmm. I think. So if you take that kind of psychological component and add it to if somebody has a susceptibility to addiction, then they're hitting the road running.
Sure.
If I'm in an environment in my home and there's addiction there, what, you know, obviously that's an environment that might promote my use, whether I'm the spouse or not. What are some of the things I might be able to do? What can I do?
We talked about 12-step groups. It's a great resource, but if your parents aren't supportive, then that would make it particularly difficult. I think if you have a trusted adult in your life, whether it's your school counselor or a neighbor or an aunt or someone that could help you, it's hard to get healthy when you're in an unhealthy environment, so you have to be really motivated to change. But there are programs out there.
We often hear about if there's a mentor, like you're saying, someone else who might be in somebody's life that might help them with the resiliency, that those relationships can be very impactful even when you're in environments that might have risk factors.
Absolutely. A lot of churches are where meetings are held.
Yeah.
So a pastor or someone, a priest that you trust is a great resource as well.
Talk about the emotional toll that it takes on someone who has this sort of exist in this environment with this addict.
It's very stressful. We tell families that come to family group that they've basically been through a trauma and have PTSD-like symptoms. You know, a lot of times there's violence or maybe emotional abuse. People generally walk on eggshells around addicts, so it's kind of that waiting for the other shoe to drop feeling of never knowing if what you're doing is going to be right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. When I think about, you know, the addictive environment and, you know, the toll that it might play, it makes me think also what role spirituality might have with this. Is that something that you talk about in the work that you do with the families?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. The 12-step program is largely a spiritual program. And the nice thing about it is that it's important that the person choose a God of their own understanding. So it's not something that we tell them, hey, if you do this, you know, this is what will happen. But it's kind of gaining their trust in order that they might come to believe eventually that God can really work in their life.
Yeah. Sometimes overcoming this addictive environment means that you have to overcome temptation. You know, you put it in spiritual language. What does that look like? How does someone, you know, deal with that temptation, deal with that environment? Even you can take the example of Christ and immediately was tempted, and yet he responded in a certain way. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think the stronger the person's foundation is in recovery, the less the temptation becomes. In the beginning, people don't really trust that, and it's a good idea not to put yourself in those kinds of environments if you're not ready.
For sure.
Some of the 12-step literature will tell you if you don't have another purpose to be there, say in a bar or at a party, then it's probably not a good idea to be there. But generally, people are taught that they can really pray to have the temptation removed, and so they should experience that less and less as the longer they're sober.
It sounds like what you're teaching the addict is how to make healthy choices about environments to be in. Is that something that's shared then with the family as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We talk to the family about what they have in the home, if they're willing to have a sober home. We use the analogy that if your loved one was diagnosed with diabetes, would you have a big cake on the table waiting for them when they came home? Mm. So it's really about providing a safer, more healthy environment.
What guidance would you give to a church or a faith community about creating an environment that would be healthy for people, you know, so that they don't go down an addictive path?
The more they see positive role models, first of all, right, and the more they learn about themselves and being their best self, I think really arms them with the ability to make better choices.
Jennifer, thank you so much. You've been great. Unhooked's going to be right back.
If I had to unhook myself, I couldn't do it. I know that I would. If it had not been for God unhooking me from my addictions, I'd be dead. That's real clear to me. I was stuck down in this dark place, this real dark place. And he reached down and I think he grabbed me way before I actually came into his light, because somebody was holding me up through all of this. And my wife and I probably, I don't know how many hundreds of books we've had in this house for different addictions and for her codependency and things like that. But the best book that we have ever found has been the Bible. The Bible is the book of recovery for any kind of addiction that a person might run into. It's just, I know that I always believed in a God. And I know that through Vietnam and through all of my drug addictions and everything like that, he was always right there with me. But also, people have to remember that this is Satan's world. When I heard that, it was like so much stuff in my life finally made sense. Because I always thought, well, if this is a loving, caring God, how can we be going through all this insanity? Why is there all this stuff going on? When I realized this is actually Satan's playground, and he's trying to do away with all of us, addictions are one of his best weapons, because he can infect the one person in a family or in a community, and it can affect the whole community. So it has truly been a blessing to be able to understand really now what God has done with my life and how my wife and I can use all the insanity that we have been through to now help other people. My name is John, and I'm unhooked.
Hello, friends. We've just learned from Jennifer how family environments are critical to the etiology of addiction, how children learn in those families how to live for better or for worse, how modeling that parents do for their children is critical to their future development. We learned from John that his family life was difficult, and he learned so many things in his family and in his military experience that led him into a life of addiction. We learn many things from our families. One of them is that there are rules in dysfunctional families, or in families where addiction occurs, that are not helpful to the children. Some of those rules are things like, don't talk about what really is going on in this family, because you're going to make this family look bad. Don't trust anybody with what's going on in this family either. Keep secrets in this family, but you know, it's those secrets that really, really hurt us. We also learn in addictive family other rules like, be perfect. You have to look good so that this family looks good. Or be good, even though I'm not good and I may be an addict parent. I may not be doing good, but you need to look good so that this family looks good. Another rule we learn in dysfunctional families is, don't have your feelings. Because if you have your feelings as a child, that means I have to face my feelings. And I don't want to do that because I'm too filled with guilt and with shame. You know, there's no need for guilt and shame. We're told in In Romans chapter 8, verse 1, there is therefore now no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus. And so Jesus is not condemning you either. No matter what you've done, no matter how you've hurt yourself or how you've hurt others or how you've even hurt God, there is no condemnation. He looks upon you with compassion and with love. He wants you. And He not only wants you, He wants to give you freedom. Freedom from the addictions that may be plaguing your life or the life of a loved one. There is freedom for you today. For more information about how you can break away from habits that hurt, contact Adventist Recovery Ministries. And for prayer, call 1-888-446-7388. Choose to become unhooked today.